This is Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Peter Payette. My guest this morning is Russ Mason. He's chief of the Wildlife Division at the Department of Natural Resources and Environment. This year, the state changed some rules for deer hunting in some parts of lower Michigan. Hunting on private land started yesterday. The state's trying to change the habits of hunters, give them more opportunities to shoot does as opposed to bucks. That's because there are too many deer in some parts of the state. It's a problem for farmers, for drivers, and let's face it, for auto insurance companies. But in some places, there are not enough, particularly in the Upper Peninsula. It's Russ Mason's job to satisfy all the competing interests and handle other problems that crop up in Michigan's woods and wild places. And he joins us this morning on Points North. Hello, Russ.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. How are you today?
As well as can be expected, I guess, in these uncertain times.
I see. Well, maybe you could, just for a little background, explain something that I don't think is well understood, especially if one is not a hunter, and that is that the deer hunting, the further north you go, the worse it tends to get.
Well, that's more or less true. I mean, you know, 25 or 30 years ago, deer hunting in southern Michigan was poor. And everyone went north, but now, actually because of a whole host of changes, deer hunting along the Ohio-Indiana line is probably better than it is just about anywhere else in the state. And that's because we've got all kinds of edge habitat, we've got plenty of agricultural crops, we have, frankly, urban development, which favors deer, or suburban development, which favors deer. And at the same time, in the last couple of years up north, we've had hard winters. Timber harvest practices have changed in ways that don't favor deer, and so we've got our challenges set out for us.
There was a gentleman who speaking to the Grand Rapids Press, and he was with some association of quality deer management for central western Michigan. I'm not quite sure where that would be exactly, but his comment was that in their area they're overrun by deer. Can you assess when it would be appropriate and where it would be appropriate to say the state is overrun by deer?
Well, overrun is a relative statement. I mean, you know, I wouldn't say that we are overrun with deer. I think that there are perspectives here. You know, what we're really talking about in almost every case is what the impacts or perceived impacts of deer are. Do they have an impact to forestry? Do they have an impact to agriculture? Are there too many car hits? Are guys seeing enough deer in the woods? It's the impacts rather than the actual number that are important. The guys in the western Upper Peninsula, frankly, are very interested, particularly the quality deer management folks, in altering the sort of the proportion of deer, males to females, and also putting other kinds of restrictions in place to sort of change the character of the deer herd. In fact, Leelanau County, their QDM, came forward at the commission meeting in August with a request to put antler point restrictions in place in 11 counties in the northwest lower peninsula to try to produce the same kind of deer herd in those counties that they are now seeing in Leelanau as a consequence of point restrictions. And the idea here, by the way, is to, for those that don't hunt, or even for those that do, is if you put a point restriction in, 3 points on a side or 4 points on a side, it results in deer getting a little bit older, bucks getting a little bit older. And so in Leelanau County, in any case, because of this regulatory antler point restriction, or APR, we are seeing a change in the age structure of the population relative to, say, Traverse County, or Grand Traverse County, or Benzie. And they are also practicing taking a few more does, the result being that you're going to synchronize rut and you're going to once again increase the likelihood of a deer herd that is both healthy and has large bucks in it, which is something that hunters typically prefer.
And when you going back to your comment about perceived impacts of the size or maybe the character of the deer herd out there and real impacts, what are the real impacts from the view of the of your office that that the state feels it needs to deal with right now?
Well, there's a couple of pieces to that. I spent nearly 20 years before starting to work for state government doing animal damage control, and a lot of that had to do with white-tailed deer and other species. And so when you talk about agricultural impacts, there are cases where guys are suffering real, measurable damage. And for those folks, we need to do things. In areas, for example, in fruit-growing areas, deer can be very damaging to hybrids, apple hybrids, for example, by cropping the top of trees and changing the whole character of an orchard. And they can also get into row crops and cause issues. On the other hand, a lot of animal damage control issues that farmers, particularly for row crops, complain about are more perceived than anything else. You know, if you look at the causes of loss, whether it's fungus or insects or drought or whatever, those are far more important than the losses to vertebrates. But on the other hand, you can see a deer in your field. You can't see the fungus. You can see the deer. And as it turns out, so you're mad at the deer or madder at the deer than you are at the fungus that may be there. So that's one piece of it. Michigan leads the country in terms of automobile deer collisions. So there are some areas where deer are sufficiently abundant that we have problems, and that's particularly true in the southern part of the state. One of the issues that we face is that we just can't get people to shoot enough deer in southern Michigan. And so we have put all kinds of things in place. You know, you can this year get five antlerless deer tags in a day, and essentially as many as you want. It's not because we think that we're going to succeed in getting everybody out there to do this. The typical Michigan deer hunter hunts 4 days a year or less and takes one or perhaps two deer. So putting five antlerless tags out there is not likely to have a substantial impact, but it may encourage a few other folks to get out there and shoot some deer and have an impact. That's in Area 486, which is essentially southern Michigan below Route 10.
So in essence, you're saying to hunters down there, you can take as many deer as you can shoot, not bucks, but
yeah, exactly, as many as you want. You know, it's a delicate balancing act, frankly, because I do not want to devalue deer. It's very important that to me that we maintain the value of what amounts to an iconic species, not just in the state of Michigan but elsewhere. At the same time that we address issues. And here it's impact issues, whether that's vehicle collisions, perceived agricultural damage, real agricultural damage, damage in suburban areas. At the same time, we're going to have to be looking for more innovative solutions. You know, one of the issues that we face in southern Michigan is firearm restrictions or just hunting restrictions that prevent deer from being taken where, in fact, they need to be removed. If in Connecticut you can have archery hunts in subdivisions with eighth to quarter acre lots, it's clear that we could do more here. And so we are in the process of developing a problem or urban-suburban deer management plan that is sort of derivative from the deer management plan that we finished for the state last year.
So I noticed that this early hunting that started yesterday on private land, there are some places in northern Michigan where this is allowed, part of Charlevoix County, I think I saw on the list, and then some counties over in the eastern side of northern Michigan. What's going on in those places that you feel like more deer need to be harvested?
Well, again, it's a local abundance issue. You know, I was hunting yesterday, 15 miles north of Mount Pleasant. By the way, it was a terrible opener. It rained really, really hard. Again, there are local abundance issues. In the future, in the very near future, we are going to be doing things in quite different ways in the state of Michigan. First, we're going to be establishing regional deer advisory teams in the Upper Peninsula, in the Northern Lower Peninsula, and in the southern part of the Lower Peninsula to tune deer management to the unique situations that we encounter in those parts of the state. We're going to be looking to the members of that group to be true partners in working with the Wildlife Division to make recommendations to the Natural Resources Commission about regulation, to evaluate the social adequacy and the biological adequacy of policies and regulations that we put in place. And maybe over time also moving away from this concept of DMU, deer management unit by deer management unit regulation, to something that is more landscape-based, maybe it's Upper Peninsula, Northern Lower, Southern Lower, which will, on the one hand, allow us to set more uniform regulations, which are simpler, and that, by the way, is a priority of mine, to make simpler regulations, at the same time that we may be able to set up special hunts within those zones that deal very locally with particular kinds of issues. And what comes to mind there are the the use of crop damage permits or deer management assistance permits, which are something that are available to landowners to deal with local issues. One of the problems that we have is we may issue deer management assistance permits in an area where there are no antlerless tags, for example, parts of the eastern Upper Peninsula. That inflames passions, I think, would be a diplomatic way of putting the way that deer hunters may feel about it, at the same time that those landowners may have real problems. If we go to zonal management and set up specific hunts, we may be able to do more and issue fewer damage assistance permits.
So generally speaking, how is all that different from how you manage deer and deer hunting right now?
Well, the way that we do it now is we have lots and lots of deer management, what we call DMUs or deer management units. They could be county-sized or in some cases smaller than county-sized. And so we're managing deer at what almost becomes a biologically inappropriate level of scale, so that we really have a hard time evaluating what the impacts of regulation change might be. So, for example, if we were to implement an antler point restriction at a DMU level, deer moving in and out of that DMU might dilute any possibility of evaluating whether the antler point restriction had the desired impact, which is to advance the age structure, say, in the buck population. So we need to begin thinking about how we set regulations at a larger landscape scale so that we come up with something that is explicitly measurable. The Wildlife Division right now is just now completing a strategic planning exercise that will dictate changes in the organization of the division and also the way that we do business. And one of the parts of the way that we do business is that everything from now on that we do, not just some things, but everything that we do will be in an adaptive management framework. We are going to be evaluating the impacts of what we do. In order to accomplish that goal, we have to think about the scale at which we do those evaluations. And frankly, the division now is sufficiently small that, we've lost over 100 people in the last decade in terms of the size of the division. We have to be measuring things at a level where we can collect the data, where our resources and our personnel will allow us to, we have the resources to bring to bear to get the data that we need to move forward.
So how is it that you think that you're going to be able to gather more data, have regulations for deer hunting that are more, specific to locales if you're running short of people to gather that data and come up with very specific rules for smaller and smaller geographic areas?
Well, let's say we were working at a much larger level. So we set general regulations for a very large level, which then changes our data collection scheme for that larger level. Fewer personnel, maybe fewer deer checks. At the same time, we may have local issues to deal with within that larger area, and so we can then take our resources, where now we're spreading them thinly across the state. We will have set up a monitoring framework which will be less taxing, and then will give us the liberty to focus in on specific target areas when we need to do so, if you see what I'm saying. Does that make sense to you?
I think so. But let me say this. That's Russ Mason. He is Chief of the Wildlife Division at the Department of Natural Resources and Environment. We're talking about the deer herd in Michigan, which is an important part of the hunting tradition in the fall, especially up north, but all over the state. And the state is trying to manage the fact that in some places there are just too many deer. But changing the habits of hunters can be difficult. If you would like to join in our conversation, you could do it at 276-5200. So for many years, the problem that the state has faced is that there's just less people hunting. And some of the data I've seen for the number of young people that are interested in hunting and the technical or the bureaucratic term is recruited into to participate in hunting is quite small, sort of frighteningly low. I saw the Lansing State Journal open an editorial a little while back. I think it was the Journal, saying that in the future we might have to pay people to shoot animals because we'll just have too many and not enough people interested in hunting. What does that look like from where you sit these days?
Well, again, it's kind of a relative thing. I came from the state of Nevada, where there were genuinely few hunters because there were also genuinely few tags. We in Michigan on the opening of firearm deer season had 735,000 people out there last year trying to chase deer. That's larger than the entire population of a place like Wyoming, South Dakota, North Dakota. So we still have an enormous amount of interest in this. We have probably 100,000 pheasant hunters in the state. Michigan still ranks among the top 10, believe it or not, in terms of pheasant hunting opportunity. We have 40,000 duck hunters in the state. So we still have very large numbers, but you're absolutely right that we do have some issues with, as you said, recruitment. That is to say, how we maintain the tradition. It's important that we do because almost all conservation dollars in the state of Michigan are derived from the sale of hunting and fishing licenses. The division right now gets less than 6% of its budget from tax dollars. So essentially, the tax base in the state of Michigan does not play a significant role in the management of wildlife in this state. So it becomes very important to continue to recruit people into these activities, not just kids, but adults as well. Folks that may have been hunters at one time and stopped, or people that would like to start to hunt but don't know how. And so we're addressing this a number of different ways. First, it occurred to me and others a while back that we talk a lot about what kids want, but as I've said to others, you know, I don't know what my 13-year-old wants on a daily basis, and I live with her. So maybe it's worthwhile that we begin to talk directly to young people and see what it is that they want to see in a hunting experience. And to that end, we're forming what we're going to call a youth council in the division, that is to say young people, college and high school age, to try to get an idea of what they say they want. Another thing we're looking at is ways to develop more effective ways to get women and families involved in hunting. Along those lines, looking at the possibility of simplifying some of our hunter education requirements, because right now they present a barrier in many cases to adults getting into the field. I mean, I don't know a lot of 30, 40-year-old people that are going to squeeze themselves into a little desk in a first-grade classroom for a couple of Saturdays to learn how to hunt. We need to do better there. So maybe we can put this into the park interpretive program, use our parks and recreation opportunity as a way to get more people into it. Maybe we can set up weekends, for example, where we bring people to a location, and during the course of that weekend, we put them through a hunter education program. We take them to the field with mentors and allow them to harvest game, and then finally how they prepare it at the end so that we give them the whole experience. And to that end, we're working with folks like the National Wild Turkey Federation or Pheasants Forever to try to create some of those experiences so that folks that, adults, for example, that would like to get into the field or like to take their children, we'll give them the experience and the know-how to get there. You know, we talk a lot about kids being over-scheduled these days, and certainly that's true. If I look at my kids, I mean, I've got soccer games and volleyball games and choir and all kinds of stuff, but it's a matter of priority. To say that your kid is overscheduled is basically to say that I'm putting a higher priority on activities other than being outside, being in the outdoors and hunting, for example. And so we need to look at that to see if we can't upregulate the priority. One thing we are doing along those lines, since it turns out that one of the key issues to getting to people to go is opportunity. And by opportunity, having something, someplace you could go within a very short distance from your home, we are refocusing the Wildlife Division's efforts on improvement of state game areas in southern Michigan so that we provide maximum opportunity and, frankly, maximum quality. It's a playoff between those things in southern Michigan, where southern lower peninsula, where the Wildlife Division has most of its land. We have 480,000 acres, basically almost all of it below Clare. What can we do to provide additional opportunity close to population centers so that people, if they choose to go, they can just go? It's not going on safari. So all kinds of things are going on these days.
Is there any evidence, though? I mean, I know that, of course, it's of interest to the state, and I know these big outfitter companies, retailers, Cabela's, obviously they have a big vested interest in these traditions continuing on into the future. Is there any evidence that there's much anybody can do to, as you say, change the priorities of of families in this day and age?
Well, I guess there's two phrases that I could, two thoughts there. First, you know, you can't kill coyotes if you leave your rifle in the truck, which is another way of saying we need to get out there and try different things. We often will throw more and more money at the same thing, and I'm pretty sure we all know that's a definition of insanity, doing the same thing and expecting a different result. So we need to be looking at some of these other possibilities. We are in the process now of trying to understand how our new, we're in the process of putting in place a new licensing system in the state, an automated system. And with that, we will be able to do a little bit more data mining to understand what the linkages are, to provide those to ourselves and also to inform some of our partners and folks like Cabela's or Gander Mountain or just local sporting goods stores. They are our partners in terms of trying to get people to either stay as hunters and conservationists or to become hunter conservationists, and so we are working with them. We are also trying other sorts of strategies. For example, at the last commission meeting, we signed a memorandum of agreement with the Building and Construction Trades Association, the presumption there being that a lot of their members are interested in the outdoors. And maybe with them, we can work through non-traditional partners to try to reach out and both sustain and grow hunting as a vibrant, increasingly vibrant part of Michigan's sort of economic recovery.
Earlier, you were describing how most of the budget, or a great deal of the budget for your staff, is provided by hunters, and then I guess anglers in the state would be another major source of revenue for the department. You know, in recent years, as people have looked at the declining numbers of hunters, and maybe to some extent people who fish too, but especially hunters, there's been a lot of talk about other people who like to use the outdoors and use public lands in Michigan paying in. I think the head of your department, Becky Humphreys, even said to the big conservation group in the state, Michigan United Conservation Clubs, and this is going back a number of years, that it's time to figure out how other folks can chip in. So these would be birders and maybe hikers and I don't know who else, but where are we on that?
Oh, probably about the same time as when Becky said it. There are a couple of things. First, you mentioned fishing. Incidentally, there's a greater decline in the number of fishermen in the state of Michigan than the number of hunters.
Is that right?
And that has to do mostly with lack of access. At least that's what the literature suggests. So we're quite concerned with that. But you bring up a really important point. We talk a lot about how there are increasing numbers of birders and hikers and whatever using state land, and that we should be attending to that. Fundamentally, we need to recruit those people to paying for their opportunity, just like hunters and fishermen do. I, for example, would love to see the sport card program turned into a habitat card program. So if you step onto our ground, whether walking your dog, taking a hike, picking a berry, looking for a mushroom, looking at a bird, you're going to have one of those cards in your wallet. And you're going to at least provide some base funding to continue to maintain our public land. You know, we have 4.5 million acres of state forest, almost 500,000 acres of state game land, and yet for Wildlife Division, we're 160 people right now. The Forest Management Division is under the same kinds of constraints. You know, there have been good things in the past. This outdoor passport is a wonderful thing, and I encourage everybody who might be listening to enroll in that program and to get the appropriate license plate. But those dollars essentially benefit the Wildlife Division not at all. They don't benefit law, really. There's some benefit to forest management. So we need to come up with other funding sources, and one of those things would be just a base minimal fee that if you're going to come onto state land, you're going to carry one of those cards. Somebody might say, well, is that enforceable? You know, how are you going to know? And the answer is, I'm going to trust that most people, oh, sure, there's somebody that's going to not do it, but most people will do the right thing if you give them an option to. At least that's the That's what I'm going to say anyway. And so if we ask that people do that, I suspect that many people will, and we will generate additional dollars. So we're exploring those things. MUCC, the Michigan United Conservation Clubs, is exploring some possibilities. But the climate right now, frankly, isn't, at least as far as I'm told and I believe, isn't right for some new tax. You know, right now we're trying to figure out how we pave our roads, how we send our kids to school, how we keep unemployed people with some funding so they're not thrown from their homes. All of these are really important issues. Ours is just one among many of those. But as time goes on, I think we will come up with a solution that allows us to recruit the financial support, shall we say, of birders and others in conservation in this state.
Although I would think even in good times that might it might take a while to sell that. I know I was this summer, I canoed the Pine River, which I had not done in many years, and I was surprised to find out I had to get a permit and pay a couple bucks to be on the Pine. And it's not that I didn't have $4. It's just that it surprised me to find out that I had to buy a tag to put my boat in a river in the state of Michigan and float down it.
Yeah, there's an interesting dialectic between public and with a capital P resource and having to pay for that versus any other kind of recreational activity. People will drop $40-$50 on 18 holes of golf and consider themselves lucky. You know, oh, I got a bargain, as opposed to, I don't know, paying $4 to put their canoe on a river and spend the entire day. I don't know quite what that's about, and it's hard to understand, except to say that when we talk about outdoor recreation, it's almost a misnomer. It's not exactly recreation. It's a reconnection with something that is far more fundamental. I say to people, and a lot of people don't understand, you know, hunting is recreation, but it's not. It's a theological endeavor. It's a reconnection. It's a spiritual thing, if you want to get, I don't know, mushy about it. The point being that there's something fundamentally different about going out and quietly observing nature or participating in nature that is unlike any other kind of recreational endeavor. And so when you begin asking people to pay for it or have any discussion, actually, the potential for real controversy is there because it's recreation, but it's not.
And let me say, you're listening to Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Peter Payette. I'm talking to Russ Mason. He's chief of the Wildlife Division at the Department of Natural Resources and Environment. And you could join in our conversation if you would like with a question or a comment at 276-5200. It also seems, Russ, that the prospect for controversy, if you have more paying users, if there are more types of groups with different interests than hunters using the woods, that their demands will be different. I have a friend who's an ecologist and trained as a fisheries biologist and does a lot of birding. And I can't remember if he referred to the deer population as rats or seagulls, but it was one of those two. And to him, they're just a giant nuisance, and there's way too many of them. And they, trash the landscape from the vantage point of someone who's interested in birds and other aspects of the web of life out there. What can you say about deer and what we've grown accustomed to do with the large number of deer we have in this state?
Well, there are a couple of things. There's no question that when deer cross certain thresholds, they can have very noticeable and very negative impacts on a variety of non-game species. Your friend maybe's a birder, or she's a birder. I don't know. And it's very clear, for example, from data that have been collected in northeast Pennsylvania, that deer overabundance can decrease, have significant impacts on what we call understory bushes and so forth that are provide nesting habitat for neotropical songbirds and, in fact, have enormous impacts. At the same time, it's a balancing act. Folks should understand right out of the gate that in order to obtain the way that we support conservation in this state at present, and this sets up the controversy where I think you're going, is we take hunters' license dollars, we match that to funding that we get from the federal government, essentially one of our dollars for three of their dollars. In order to obtain those dollars, we have assent legislation, which means that we agree to spend the dollars in certain ways. And that, by the way, that not just for example, lands that we purchase, but other things. So there is no doubt this issue where what we're going to call non-consumptive users, I'm not sure that's quite the right phrase, say those that don't hunt and those that do, where there will be conflicts. But frankly, at this point, okay, as it turns out, that's a problem I'd kind of like to have, because at present we're getting all of those demands from folks that that don't hunt, and at the same time they don't pay. So at this point, it's we're getting half the deal. I get the complaints, I just don't get the funding. So let's work on the funding, and then we can all sit down at the table and decide where we're going to go.
You mentioned earlier that timber harvesting practices up north have had an impact on the deer herd. What's happening now? My understanding is that increasingly the markets for timber are just depressed or not even there, and that when state and federal agencies ask, put out a piece of land for to have some harvesting done, increasingly it'll go there'll be no bid.
There's two pieces. Actually, there's several pieces. It's a very complicated issue. Let's start first with the part that you mentioned, and that is to say that, you know, historically, timber harvest has been very strong in the state of Michigan, particularly in the northern lower and in the UP. You're right, timber markets are depressed. I've heard folks, that is to say folks in the forest industry in the UP, say that you can harvest lumber or harvest trees in the Amazon and ship them to Escanaba, process them for cheaper than you can cut them in the UP and truck them to the mill. It's also true that you can grow pine in Georgia and in other parts of the Southeast faster and with fewer restrictions than you can produce it here in Michigan. So we have some challenges there. And it's very important, and not just for deer. For example, we have sharptail grouse in the UP. We had prairie chicken and sharptail in the northern lower. And the presence of those birds was a function of open spaces that was created by timber harvest. So we have some challenges. We need to figure out how we are going to upregulate timber harvest again in the state of Michigan for wildlife purposes as well as for forest products. Now, here's the other piece. There are a lot of folks that will say, we want to just sort of leave it alone. Entropy is as the preferred management practice. I'm pretty sure that's kind of a neo-romantic view that if you leave nature alone, it'll take care of itself. And, well, no. As it turns out, most of our systems are so highly contrived at the present time that they do something, but it's not clear that they'd be doing what people want. So we need to be thinking and trying to educate people about the value of new forests. Young plantings, that's to say folks don't like clear cuts, for example, at the same time that they are enormously beneficial to a wide range of species, not only game species like deer, for example, or woodcock or grouse, but also for species like golden wing warbler, which has been petitioned for listing, or the Kirtland warbler, for example, which depends on both jackpine and large openings. We need to be mindful of the fact that people's aesthetics in terms of what they think the woods should look like and the biological reality don't necessarily match up. And we need to be working with folks so that there's an appropriate balance and we create the habitat that we need to create. Now you might say, well, what used to happen? Well, as it turns out, the Native Americans were really good at setting fires. They still do on Walpole Island, for example, to maintain habitat, to create openings. And then there were other sorts of natural occurrences that created large openings. We spend a lot of time and effort right now, for example, suppressing fire in the state of Michigan because it turns out it's bad for people and their property. At the same time, because we do that, we have suppressed ecological processes that are incredibly important for diversity of wildlife and ecosystem maintenance. We, as it turns out, as another species on the environment, on the landscape, have, I think, a responsibility to maintain all of those open spaces, because in the absence of those, we end up with not a biological desert, but a real paucity of wildlife species in the state that I think would, in the long run, be something that people would not want.
Let's bring in a call. Fred in Northport. Good morning, Fred. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I want to applaud your program. Thanks. And being a nature lover, in fact, I applaud your points north all the time. That's good.
Why,
being a nature lover, I would really affirm hiking the fees or making something repayable to the DNR or to the people that are in need of caring for the earth. A few years ago, we were on the Ossabel, and the people that were surrounding us in their canoes going past us, the behavior was despicable in terms of what they did about throwing their cans and bottles in the river, you know, and what they were doing as far as behavior, you know, in a piece of society out there in nature. Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call.
You betcha. Thank you.
Actually, Fred brings up one other point that's worth talking about a bit, which is something we almost never talk about, and we really, really should, is cumulative impact. It turns out you cannot do everything all the time, every place. Just can't, you know. But folks don't tend to look at it that way, or at least some folks don't. So we need to be talking about how we manage state lands here in Michigan with an eye, being mindful towards cumulative impact concerns. You cannot both, you know, mountain bike, horseback ride, hunt, fish, hike, berry pick, you know, all in the same place at the same time. We need to be thinking about how we essentially partition our public lands so that everybody has something in a place that they cherish and a place to go, at the same time that they aren't doing it shoulder to shoulder at the same time in the same place.
Hey, Russ, earlier, and we just have a couple minutes left, but you were talking about the character of the deer herd in Leelanau, Benzie, Grand Traverse counties. I had a Facebook question. Someone was asking how closely you can tell us the ratio of bucks to does around this that area.
You know, that's a question I couldn't answer directly. If you wanted to forward that question to me, I'll answer it straight up. I'll talk to our deer specialist and get it to the guys. What we have seen, I can tell you, is since they put in the, this is the one that, you know, I have off the top of my head, is that the age structure in Leelanau County, at least for bucks, is now they're large numbers of 2.5, substantial numbers of 3, 4, and 5-year-old bucks in that area. At the same time that the character of the herd in Benzie and Grand Traverse is still 1.5, the majority of animals being harvested, and therefore the majority of the animals in the herd is still 1.5 to 2.5-year-old animals.
All right. Well, Russ, thanks for your time this morning.
Ah, it's a pleasure.
All right. We'll do it again. Russ Mason's Chief of the Wildlife Division at the Department of Natural Resources and Environment. And you're listening to Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Peter Payette. We'll be right back after a quick break.